Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this, our closing keynote of InfoSecurity Europe 2016. I think we've got a great session lined up for you here on artificial intelligence, implants and future security issues. I'm delighted to be able to welcome Kevin Warwick, who is professor at the Universities of Reading and Coventry, who's going to share his thoughts and his research and experience in this area. So I'd just like to invite Kevin to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you, Vicky. So I'm going to be talking about what the title, implants, particularly I've done some experiments myself, so I'll talk about those, but linking it in with artificial intelligence of one kind or another. So I've got a lot to talk about. I'll get on with it straight away. The first area I'm going to look at is what's now called biohacking. It's an area that's really growing. There's a lot of people doing it themselves, but also quite a few companies involved. And each of these areas, you'll see the sort of security problems, but also the opportunities that they throw up. This is a young version of me and my GP. So this was done on the National Health. And what the guy implanted, not the thing on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, it's a radio frequency identification device, RFID. It's the same sort of thing that you have on a smart card, only this was you can see the size of it, a little tube that was surgically implanted in my left arm. And the building that I was in then at Reading University was wired up to monitor my progress at different points throughout the building. So what we got it to do, as I walked down the corridor, the lights came on. As I walked towards my laboratory, the door opened automatically because the computer knew it was me. Coming through the front door, the computer said, "Hello, Professor Warwick." So it was really cool and good fun. It was just to show what's possible with technology like that. Now, clearly, opportunities there, different information, perhaps an extra passport ID. Certainly, if somebody said to me, "You can have one of these and you get through passport control a lot more quickly," I think most people would probably say, "Okay, I'll have one of those." Nowadays, a lot of people that have them implanted, it's just the size of a grain of rice. It does the same sort of thing, but you need to read it a lot more closely. It's the same technology, in fact, that cats and dogs. Has anybody got a cat or a dog with a chip implanted? It's all right. Several. You can feel content that the technology was fully tested on humans before your animal obtained it. Now on to the next one. This is thinking in terms of robots and artificial intelligence of a different kind. When you think of robots, technology, you tend to think of something that's either remote controlled, like a bomb disposal robot, remote controlled by a human, or it's controlled by a computer, microprocessor. Well, there are other ways of doing it. And particularly if we look now, on the right-hand side of the picture is the technology, the body, if you like. And we'll see in a moment, a little robot on wheels, so it moves around on wheels nice and easy for research. But it has ultrasonic sensors, ultrasonics like a bat sensing the world. What we've done is not use a computer to control it, but a biological brain, using brain cells either taken from rat embryos or brain cells from humans. On the left-hand side, you'll see the control mechanism. It says MEA. This is a multi-electrode array. So, in fact, a little dish with electrodes on the bottom of it, and we put the brain cells in the dish. It has to be kept in an incubator at 37 degrees centigrade because it's living tissue. It has to be fed. What happens? It's amazing with brain cells. Well, you separate them using enzymes. So there you go, you just got brain cells separately. And you put them in a dish. What brain cells like to do is to put out little tentacles so that they can link up with other brain cells. So this is something that's innate. It's something that happens with brain cells. They want to communicate. And it amazes me when people say children shouldn't be working on computers and things like that. Well, I mean, it's an innate thing, is to communicate and interact. It's something that your brain cells want to do. And we can see that happening under the microscope. After about 10 days, we have a complex network there. The brain cells are linked up, some of them very close by to other brains, some of them much longer distances. And what we do then is give the brain a body. We put the brain in the robot body. And you'll see now, the gold electrodes are how we communicate with the brain. Essentially, we'll see a robot moving around. When it detects an object, signals are sent into the brain. The black rings are to stop the brain dehydrating. We have to keep it moist. The brain will then do its stuff as brains do, and will make a decision, and another electrode will pick up the signals which will cause the robot to move. So the robot, you're going to see, the only control that causes it to change directions are instructions from the brain, the culture. So here we go. This is the first robot. So this is after about 10 days development. So the brain has been developing for about 10 days. And you'll see it operating here. Here we go. So it detects the wall and changes direction. That's what we want it to do. Then it changes its mind and turns around and crashes into the wall, which is not what it's supposed to do. But this is just a baby robot. The brain is only 10 days old. So what we're looking at here is how the brain develops over time. Every time it gets it right, every time it got it right, it turned, okay, it gets it wrong. We're not so worried about when it gets it wrong. Every time it gets it right, the passageway through the brain that causes that to happen strengthens a little bit more, gets a little bit stronger. And you can see the development over time under the microscope. It's not easy to pick out which connections are developing, growing stronger, but you can see it happening over a broad spectrum of them. So we can see how the robot develops. What's called habitual learning, Hebbian learning. It's the same sort of thing. If you are driving regularly the same route to work, you end up after a few months, you think, well, I'm not even thinking about it. I'm doing it automatically. Well, you are thinking about it, but it's your brain has become so programmed with what you're doing, you don't think deeply about it. It's the same sort of thing here. We can see this habitual learning occurring. So it's a different form of artificial intelligence. But you can see the robot crashing into the wall sometimes, and sometimes it gets it right. Now, it does this for about 1 hour every day in the laboratory. And I'm now going to fast forward. And this is the same robot, the same brain, after 2 months. And you'll see how it's developed through this habitual learning, going through that process. And we'll see it detect the wall. Great. And now, this actually, I've picked a good one here. This is a good robot. You know, it's a good student, because this robot has had a university education, you must remember, and this one works quite well. So we've picked out a good example here. Of course, it's what MIT always do, so we all should follow that. And in fact, this gets a little bit boring, sorry about that, because it gets it right all the time now. It's done it so well. Not all of them do this. Some of them still hesitate a bit. Some of them are quite blasé and go crashing the wall. It's because they're brain cells and they develop in different ways. We know what we want it to do, but it doesn't always do what we want it to do. Mainly we use rat neurons because rats aren't particularly popular, and it's easier to get ethical approval perhaps to use rat brain cells, but it's also quite possible to use human brain cells. In a way it's not so good, because the rat brain cells will learn over a period of about 30 days, which is what rats do, whereas humans, of course, take an awful lot longer to learn, and we don't have time in the lab to wait for 18 years for the robot to learn how to avoid hitting obstacles and so on. the sort of numbers of brain cells we're dealing with in two dimensions, like we're talking about there, typically it'd be 100,000 to 150,000 brain cells, which is nothing like the 100 billion in a typical human brain, but it's not bad. It's reasonable, probably a lot more complex than is needed for this particular task. However, we also can culture, we can grow the brains in three dimensions, which takes the number up to 30 million. So what we're looking at here is the possibility of having 30 million human brain cells in a robot body. Just to give you, that's not, this is what's going to happen in the future, that's what is done now, that's what we use now. It's only doing simple tasks, but the future of artificial intelligence takes a number of routes, and this is one of them, having biological brains grown and put in a technological body. Now, for something, the same technology, as it were, but in a different context. And this is in the medical world for therapy. Deep brain stimulation, which we'll see an example of that in a moment, is used principally to treat people with Parkinson's disease, but it's also used for people with clinical depression, with epilepsy, Tourette's syndrome. There's a whole range of things that it's used for. The main one is Parkinson's disease. And what happens, the surgeon will drill a hole down into the central area of the brain and then will put a spindle with electrodes on the end of it into the brain. If the person has a right side and a left side Parkinson's, as we'll see in a moment, then you have two holes drilled in the person's brain and the electrodes are pushed in. The power packs are actually positioned, implanted here. And this is one of the wonderful achievements of evolution in humans, that we really don't have much. If you tap yourself, it echoes quite a bit. There's not actually a lot of stuff in your body there, no organs and things like that. Which is great, because we can put lots of technology in there. It's a nice position. So it's wonderful prediction for evolution as to what would be useful. So the power packs, the same with heart pacemakers, the power packs are positioned here. There's lots of room there to put things like that. And the power packs are positioned here. They're then wires running underneath the skin and going into the electrodes. And what it does is apply a stimulating pulse to counteract the effects of Parkinson's disease. So what I'll show you is that working now, and then I'll say a little bit more about some of the security issues involved. So this is a genuine guy with Parkinson's disease. What you'll see, first of all, is the person, the effects of Parkinson's disease. Then you'll see what happens when the assistants switch on the power packs. And this will be purely electronic stimulation of the brain. There'll be no chemical drugs that the person's taking.
In 2 minutes, what was the status of Mr. Plasman when he was referred to us by his neurologist in Belgium, and you see him before surgery without drug, unable to stand up by himself. He's helped by Patricia Limousin, who is a neurologist in our group, and he's not able to do anything of, as he will tell you, makes your life looking like normal. He's not able to walk. He has having dystonia, which are muscular contraction, deforming the different joints. And this is the best he could do without the drugs, with the help of people around him and mainly his wife and friends. He was referred because the drugs were not working anymore. He was not having any more improvement. And as he will tell you, he was just stuck to a wheelchair. This is after surgery. You see the tremor. We turn one of the two stimulators which were implanted in the electrode into his subthalamic nucleus, which is a tiny part of the brain. And you see that in a few seconds, the stimulation induces a stop of the tremor. This is still visible on the other side. We will turn on the stimulator on the right side. And you will see something even more spectacular than that. You will see that the patient feels again free, and he reset himself in his chair in the position where he feels the most important. He will obey Dr. Polak in doing some tests, even if he feels that those tests are a little bit is less as compared to the feeling he has. He can do that almost normally. On the right side, should I do it longer, does he say? And he will show it on the other side. And then he will walk, he stood up alone. He's without any drug. You see him walking, turning. It was a few days before the Vienna meeting on movement disorder.
I work with surgeons at the John Radcliffe Hospital, Oxford, where Tipu Aziz, one of those surgeons, puts at least one implant in a new patient every week. Often can be more than that. So a lot of people benefiting from this. But what we're talking about there are wires underneath the skin that potentially could be hacked into, if you like. However, what we're doing with it is picking up signals from the brain with the electrodes that I talked about before, and taking them out into an artificial intelligence system. So this is the electrical activity in the brain. And the artificial intelligence system is used to predict when the tremors and the muscle locking with Parkinson's disease, when it's going to start before it starts, so that the stimulating pulses can be applied before the tremors actually start, so they don't start, to counteract the effects of it. And with an artificial intelligence system, essentially what it's doing is understanding what's going on in the human brain and then predicting what's going to happen. And it can predict the onset of Parkinson's tremors 20 seconds ahead before they start. The person themselves doesn't know that, but the AI system does know it. So it's one of the advantages of AI. It can understand what's going on in the brain, even if you don't understand it yourself, and therefore can be used possibly in this way to help from a medical point of view. However, it gets more interesting in that the person and their brain, naturally, is situated in Oxford, in the Radcliffe Hospital. We can then take the signals from their brain, send them across the internet, and use the artificial intelligence system in Reading University, which is 40 minutes away, probably 40 miles away. The AI system then makes a decision in Reading, which is sent back as to when to stimulate and when not into the person's brain in Oxford. So effectively, part of that person's brain, in terms of decision making, is in a different place altogether, a different city, with obvious security issues involved. Now, there's lots of positives for networking a human brain in this way from a medical point of view, but of course it opens up positive and negative opportunities. The last area of implants I'm going to look at, really based on the fact that humans are pretty limited in what we can do, particularly in terms of our brains. So the possibility of enhancing with implant technology is enormous. The sort of implants, of course, the sort of help we could get, memory capabilities, increase the range of senses because we have a very limited sensory input. We miss about 95% of what's going on around us because our vision is limited in terms of frequency spectrum and so on. We miss most of the information that's around us. So why not enhance, particularly in terms of communication? This is me on the operating table at the Radcliffe Hospital. I didn't have a medical problem. This was for scientific research. And what was implanted was this. This was surgically implanted in the nervous system of my left arm. It's called the brain gate. And some of you may have seen, so I was the first human to have this, and some of you may have seen a few weeks ago on TV or certainly online, a guy in the US has had exactly the same implant who's paralyzed. He's had the same implant, he's reconnected up to a little sleeve around his arm, so that although his signals from his brain couldn't get down his nervous system, essentially they rerouted it with the implant here. It was rerouted down onto the sleeve, which stimulated his muscles, and so he was able to move his wrist and fingers to some extent. But I'll show you what I was able to do with it, which was looking a little bit outside the box. This is from Discovery TV.
One man in tune with technology is the world's first cyborg. Part man, part machine. Kevin Warwick, cybernetics professor at Reading University, England, took a leap into the future as long ago as 2002. For 3 months, a silicon chip was implanted into the nerves in his arm.
At that time, no human had had an implant of this type before.
It was a procedure that until then had only been tested on chickens.
Would the body reject it? Would it affect the way I moved or my sensory capabilities? I could have lost the use of my hand. Could it affect my brain? Ultimately, could have sent me crazy.
Kevin was plugged into a computer which monitored the nerve signals from his brain to his arm, receiving and transmitting them as radio waves. With the signals from his brain, Kevin could not only turn on lights, he could control a wheelchair. And from 5,000 kilometers away via the internet, he succeeded in getting a robot hand to mimic his own hand movements. His most impressive experiment involved his wife, Irena, also having a chip implanted in her arm.
The communication experiment between myself and Irena was vitally important to me. This was the highlight of the whole experiment.
Kevin wanted to discover if it was possible for his brain to receive and feel signals from Irena's brain.
When Irena first moved her hand, it actually felt like a charge running up my index finger. It was a phenomenal feeling. Literally, every time she moved, my brain received a signal. There we were communicating for the first time in the world, nervous system to nervous system.
It was the first time two people had electronically communicated by thought alone.
In the short term, we're going to see implants used to help people who are paralyzed switch on lights, operate the TV, just by thinking about it.
In 30 years, he believes we'll all have chips in our brains.
But ultimately, having extra memory, having downloads from the computer, uploading from the brain. Earth is going to be controlled by cyborgs. Humans are going to be something of a subspecies.
We'll be half man, half machine, with super memory, super senses, and superpowers.
I think quite clearly that's where we're going. Superhuman. You may have spotted a little bit of Nietzschean philosophy there. I mean, just to emphasize, the communication enhancement, I think, is the big one. When you think how we as humans communicate and compare that with how technology communicates, well, clearly it's embarrassing for humans. We're so poor. We have highly complex signals in our brains, thoughts, images, feelings, emotions, all of that sort of stuff and a lot more. And if we want to communicate that to somebody else, what do? Well, we convert those highly complex electrochemical signals into trivial mechanical signals, either movement, which is terrible, or almost just as bad, pressure waves, mechanical signals that are very slow. This is what speech is, very error-prone, and so on. And then somebody's ears will convert the signals back from mechanical signals into electrochemical signals. And of course, even if you've been married for 20 or 30 years, you thought, what is she saying? I have no idea. Wouldn't it be much better if we could send signals directly from brain to brain, communicate like computers do, by in terms of thoughts, in terms of images, colors, feelings, and so on? So it's looking at the possibilities for that. And what we were able to do was communicate so far from nervous system to nervous system. Clearly where it's going will be brain to brain communication, which opens up all sorts of security problems or opportunities, whichever way you want to look at it. Now, the final area I want to look at are machines pretending to be human and seeing if you can detect from conversation whether they are human or not. Now, this we pick up in Turing's imitation game, the Turing test, which you may or may not have heard of before. But I've been involved in organizing a whole range of Turing tests over a number of years, and I'm going to put you to test in a moment to see whether you can spot. Now, what it's all about, if you're interrogating the machine, what you're faced with is a computer with a split screen. Behind half of the screen is a machine, and behind the other half of the screen is a human, but you don't know which is which. And quite simply, as Turing set it up, you have 5 minutes to interact with both the human and the machine and then decide which is which. So that's what you've got to do. The machine is aiming to fool you, not just into thinking that it's human, but into thinking that it's more human than the human it's up against. So at the end of the time that you decide, this is the human, this is the machine, and you get it completely the wrong way around. That the human is just being human, which human, some people are not very good at that, but that's what they're trying to do. The machine is also trying to be human, but it's trying to fool you into thinking that it's more human than the human. So it's quite a tough test, and Turing set a level that it has to fool at least 30% of the interrogators, which is difficult, because 50% effectively is the, you know, that they couldn't do any better than that. That's the statistical as good as it can get. So it's a tough test for machines. Now, I've got some transcripts taken from Turing tests. Here we go. And this is where I'm going to need all of you here to try and see whether what the judge, the interrogator is conversing with, the entity is human or whether it's machine. So I'll go through it and then I'll need you to say what you think. So, hi, here we go. How do you feel about this encounter? The letters and everything, it's exactly how it appeared in the transcript. So there's not errors on my part from editing. This is how it was. I can only comment once we've had sufficient of it. Fair enough. Anyway, I almost didn't get here today. And why is that? I felt very dizzy when I woke up, and it was hard to shake off. And you had to make it on time anyways. Good job. Thanks. By the way, I meant dizzy. Bad typing. I had to drive faster than normal. And you didn't get any speed limit fine. No, luckily there was an interesting thing on the Today program this morning. And what is it, this encounter? You mean the thing on the program or the chat we're having? That's a 5 minute conversation. And this is where there's a bit of audience participation here, because I want you to tell me. Now, the point with this is if you don't answer, it's a point to the machine anyway, because you don't make the right identification, which is exactly how Turing said it. So not answering, the machine's going to get the point anyway. You get it wrong if you don't answer. But who thinks the entity here is human? Fine. So I'm picking up about 7, 8, something like that. Who thinks the entity is a machine? Hopefully you'll all agree and not go saying some blog to the contrary. Most people went for machine. So the entity was a male human. The judge decided that the entity was a machine. So the judge and who'd been interacting with it went along with the majority. And what Turing had said with the test is that the person shouldn't be an expert in machines, the words he used. But this one was. And they're actually familiar with such tests. They were an expert in artificial intelligence. In fact, they were a professor of artificial intelligence. I'm not going to tell you which university they were from. That wouldn't be fair. But we'll call it Birmingham for the sake of argument. Maybe the last line, the misunderstanding about the Today program, you know, not everybody knows it and so on. But that is interesting. In the Turing test, the interrogators often will assume, whether it's machine or human, that the machine knows what they know. In this case, the Today program. We all know what the Today program is. Well, not everybody does. But it's a problem with interrogators. Do you fancy another one? Good. Well, somebody nodded, so I'll go for it. So, again, it's a different entity, different judge, and you have to decide whether it's human or machine. Hello, how are you? Hey, how do you like Bletchley Park? I think it's lots of laughs out loud, things like that. Are you from England? They have Wi-Fi here in the pub. Which pub? I'm just down the pub. Have you ever been in a Turing test before? Will this be the 5 minute argument, or were you thinking of going for the full half hour? You have to be a Monty Python fan to know that. If you don't know what that is, watch Monty Python because it's superb. Very funny. You sound suspiciously human. Do you like the Beatles? I'd like to get the next Dread the Fear tape. What is Dread the Fear? Dread the Fear has that Steve Henderson guy in it. What sort of music is that, or is it comedy? That's it. It's 5 minutes. Getting into the hang of things here. Who thinks the entity is human? So, more than last time, but who thinks the entity is a machine? So I'm going the machine has the majority again, but it's a closer call. The entity was a machine, congratulations. But the judge identified the entity as being an adult, human, male, native English speaker. And this is interesting. Often you get the judges really giving a history. One of them we had, yeah, there's married and got kids and all. And it's a machine. But there we go. So maybe machines can be. Maybe the use of humor. Humor is an interesting thing. Some people say, oh, machines can't have a sense of humor. Well, of course they can, and it can be much broader and, or depends how you define sense of humour. They can crack jokes, and they can appear to have a sense of humour. The final one I've got, and here we go. So this is another one to decide what the entity is. Hi, nice to meet you. Please tell me how you found me and what you'd like to discuss. Nice to meet you. What about you tell me how you spend your weekend? Let's go on with our conversation. Okay, are you going to go somewhere after this? My future plans are my secret. Sorry. By the way, what's your occupation? I mean, could you tell me about your work? I'm a mad scientist, my husband says. Sanity and insanity complement each other in our complicated life. Oh, what a fruitful conversation. Conversation is about telling things each other. So now, why don't you tell me about yourself? Oh, if I tell you about myself, I'll definitely be dishonest. Well, I am a son of Rockefeller. I've arrived here in the limo. There you go. So a nice one to finish on. Again, that's the 5 minute conversation. That was all there was to it. Who thinks the entity is human? So the splattering, okay. Who thinks the entity is a machine? Majority are gone for the machine. Was a machine. Well done. The judge identified the entity again as being adult human male native English speaker. That was in fact one of the examples. We held these tests at the Royal Society 2014, and that was one of those of a machine called Eugene Gustman that passed the Turing test by fooling over 30% of the interrogators into not being able to make the right identification. So there's one example of Eugene in action. I mean, even those of you that said it's a machine, hopefully it wasn't such an easy, you know, an absolutely easy decision. It was something you had to think about. Okay, thank you very much. That's all. Apart from a few conclusions for you to take home, just from what I've been talking about, can machines help with the war on cybercrime? Well, yes, of course they can, but also they can help on the other side of the war. So it's yes and no is the answer. Is artificial intelligence a beacon of hope against the fight in the fight against cybercrime? Well, yes, of course it is. It's a new tool to use, but of course it's also good for the other side. So yes and no is the answer. How much cybersecurity authority could we hand over to AI systems? Well, it could be everything, because they're machines, they can process information a lot better than we can, so we could hand everything over, but that opens up all sorts of dangers, so if we're going for security, we should hand nothing over to machines. How much trust could humans have in machines? Well, some or none, depending on where you want to look at it. Both answers are absolutely correct. Thank you very much indeed. And I think I've timed it so we've got a few minutes if anybody wants to volunteer for implants or ask any questions, then now's your opportunity. Yes, one here. There's a mic coming about to appear.
A couple of questions, really. I mean, the first one was when you were looking at the initial brain on a chip, how do you know that it's positive reinforcement rather than negative reinforcement? Is that because of the design or...?
What we're looking at, it's a process called Hebbian learning. So it's all we're looking at there is not Not reinforcement learning. It's a more difficult thing. All we're looking at is when, what Hebbard said, if one neuron fires and that causes another neuron to fire, then the link between those two will strengthen every time that happens. And this is something that's used in backpropagation networks, artificial neural networks, a very basic tool of that. So if that particular pathway fires, and this is the same thing happening in practice. It actually happens. This is what happens in brain cells. So every time that particular action of detecting the wall or an object, whatever it is, and the robot turning, when that happens, the pathway that brings that about strengthens a little bit more. And over the period of 2 months, as you saw with that particular robot, it had strengthened so much that it did it every time. It did it automatically. If we go into reinforcement learning, it means figuring out a bit more about where the pleasure zones and the pain zones are in the brain, which I don't think we're up to just yet. When we can get where the pleasure zones are, then of course we can apply reinforcement. So every time it does it right, we can go, ah, so it feels great. And every time it does something we don't want, and you know, it's like that. Which is done with rats. I know it's pretty awful when you actually see it happening, but to cause rats to learn to follow particular paths. But in terms of brains on a chip, it's purely Hebbian type learning, habitual learning so far.
And you also said that it would take human brain cells 18 years to learn. Why would, I mean, do they actually have a different time to learn, the different brain cells then?
Yes, yeah, I mean, the brain cells bring with them innate abilities, that they've evolved to do, and rat brain cells are very useful. So a baby rat will learn all it's going to learn. If it's going to go to university and school, it has to do it within the first 28 days of its life, otherwise it's pretty stuck on that. For humans, of course, I don't know what the actual time is. It might be more 30 years or so. I'm hoping, being aged over 60, I hope it's more 70 years, to be perfectly honest. But it's a lot longer, certainly talking in terms of years rather than days. So the human brain cells are much, much slower to learn, I'm afraid. So it's okay to use them, but for this sort of experiment. And I mean, it is good because what we're trying to do is different things, like close down part of the brain, which is the same as with a stroke, and then see if the other brain cells over a period of time will adapt and learn to overcome some of the features that you've lost. And try and figure out things like where exactly are memories formed in this little brain. Because if we can figure out where memories are formed and we can add stem cells and brain cells into certain areas, maybe we can hold on to memories. So it's a way of attacking things like dementia from a practical, rather than applying chemicals to it, it's doing it the hardwired way. Which is, you know, if we can get a little bit in there and contribute to the field, then it'd be very rewarding. But no, the human brain cells and the rat brains, or any others, would bring their innate learning rates and some abilities into the problem.
The last one was on the Turing tests. It seemed to be quite straightforward which one was which, because the computers were introducing their own lines of discourse, whereas the human was actually taking deductive leaps. Seems to be very straightforward.
I'm glad you think so. I mean, not too many people got the first one right, and I was surprised. You know, maybe you're a more machine-savvy audience than normal. Very often, the majority will go for the wrong decision on all three of those. I think there are two aspects to it. One is that humans are often not all that good. Maybe I should have picked out one or two other examples where humans just go off the line. We got one example. We did tests in Bletchley Park in 2012, and there was one human there who was asked, you know, how do you like Bletchley Park? Oh, I've never been there. And so it went on. You know, what are you going to do at the weekend? Nothing really. And boring. And of course, it was a human. I mean, quite a PhD student, in fact. I wondered how can they possibly you know, are they human, really? But sometimes with humans, what the interrogator tends to be looking for is a typical human. So you can get humans who are a little bit extravagant, or again, go outside the box a little bit, or you know, a little bit devilish, as it were, can easily get picked up as a machine because they're not typical. You know, the typical human tends to be, it's more like watching EastEnders or something like that. You know, what are you doing here? Well, I just came from the pub. Oh, did you come from the pub? Yes, I came. You know, it's a bit more like that, which you do have to, I agree with what you're saying, you have to follow, the lines have to follow and the consequence of it, rather than, you know, what are you doing? I've just come from the pub, and then questioning what you mean by the word pub or something like that, which might appear to be a machine here. So maybe I picked bad examples, but maybe you did quite well as an audience here, better than normal.
Hello. 1, 2. Yeah.
No,
I was wondering how you foresaw the path of artificial intelligence moving towards consciousness, and whether sometime in the future conscious machines might acquire rights and be covered by things like data protection legislation?
Yeah. I mean, I concur with what Alan Turing said in that machines made of silicon computers operate in a very different way to the human brain. We can try and simulate and copy, but it's the same with consciousness. So the machine, just like you are a conscious human being, my laptop is a conscious laptop in a very different way, I would say. And you can switch it on and off and things like that, which maybe you can't switch you on and off so easily. So it's a very different form of consciousness. But we could simulate and potentially get very close to each other. How it's intelligent and how it thinks is different. The whole package is different. So how close could it be? Well, you know, you could get it very close, but it probably wouldn't be exactly the same because it's not made of grey matter and the same, other than if we did what we're doing there in terms of growing brains. And certainly from a lot of philosophers, John Searle, for example, would define from his philosophy that those little robots are conscious, because they have human neurons that are highly connected together and have developed over time and so on. So they may not be doing much, but in a Searle sense, they would be conscious. As for what you're talking about, I think because it's different, generally, it means there are dangers inherent with it. We may well not get machines that are thinking and are conscious in exactly the same way as humans, and that we don't necessarily understand how they are conscious. And therein lies a problem. To say, oh, you're not conscious like me, therefore you will always be subservient to me, which is Roger Penrose's philosophy, I believe is just completely wrong. We can't say, because it's different, you know, it's the same as saying, because you're, you know, you haven't got an A level in geography, therefore you're much more stupid than I am. If I did have, I don't have an A level in geography, but you get the principle of it. So I think we shouldn't take it too lightly. And the fact that the machine could be potentially super intelligent, and it could have a super consciousness, because it could have many, many more, in terms of the power, the equivalent of many more brain cells than humans could. We're limited unless we start upgrading with implants and linking with AI. So I think there are potential dangers there because of machine superintelligence.
Thank you. We're out of time now, I'm afraid. Oh. So I hope you'll join me in saying a huge thank you to Kevin for a fascinating presentation to end the whole event on. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.